Hi, welcome to LA Lit. We are here at Beta Level in Chinatown, Los Angeles, with Teresa Carmody. And LA Lit is an interview show where we interview writers in the Los Angeles area or writers who happen to be passing through the Los Angeles area. We're sponsored by Superbunker, which you can find at superbunker.com. And like I said, we're at Beta Level, which is betalevel.com. We do various events here. You can find out about them by going to their website. And I'm Matthew Timmons.
I'm Stephanie Ryu. And like Matt said, today we have Teresa Carmody with us. She's the author of Requiem, which is a micro collection of short stories. Other of her work has appeared in Poets West, Stolen Purse, Roar, the Women's Studies Journal, For Here to Go, and Fourth Street. She is co-founder of Les Figs Press, publisher of the Trench Art series, and co-curator of the Smell Last Sunday reading series in downtown LA, not too far from here.
And there's a Smell Last Sunday reading series soon after this event is over.
Yeah. Welcome.
Thanks.
Welcome. And I think we're going to hear from Requiem first.
Yeah.
If you want to explain about it, you can, or just jump in, whatever.
Okay. Well, I'm going to read a piece from the story that's in Requiem. The story's called Hurrah, Hurrah, and basically it's a series of monologues that these children are having after their father has died. So I'm going to read one of the monologues, and it's entitled Daniel. Stand it, I can't stand it. A cat'd think they'd wait a few days before asking my intentions. It's Dad's brothers and sisters, that's all, approaching me, each one at one point or another, saying, what you gonna do now, Dan? What about Grandma's house, Dan? Gonna take over your father's business, Dan? It's like, give me a break. We're at the frickin' funeral parlor, for Christ's sake. Maybe I'll take over his business, maybe I won't. But I'll tell you what, I'm not moving. No house shifting ache in my belly, no siree, I'm damn sedentary. You know, I've heard hearsay. They think I shouldn't buy Grandma's house. They want Joe in it, or Andy, hell, even Ed, one of their own. More responsible, they say, more accountable, of elevated character, or some such similar bullshit. Pff, you tell me. Who's done the work on that place for the past 7 years? Who put the new roof on and redid the cellar? Who has believed my report? Do they think I've been laboring like this so your Joe will have a nice place to live? My ass, I mean, geez, to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Get thee behind me, Satan, that's what she'd say. I'll tell you what, Dad and I had a deal. I'd take him by Grandma's house, and he'd float me the first year's loan till I could qualify on my own. Assignment, that's what it's called. And I don't see why I can't carry on with the plan. I'm a grandson, too. Dad's son, firstborn male. The one whose growth was marked as a tender plant, a root out of dry ground. So I gotta be tough, hardy, turn so hard-boiled I'm hard-shelled. And anyway, Dad's the one who always did the most for Grandma, he for her, like me for him, steady as the sun, even if I have no form or comeliness. Pa, you're right to see no beauty in me. Neither do the ladies, I'll tell you that. No matter, I haven't had the cash to date anyway, and shit, I just need to take and have some time to figure things out, collect unemployment, work odd jobs. Heck, once word gets out I'm available, I'll probably have jobs lined up for the next 2-3 months. Everybody wants me for some sort of something. Multitudes. Repairing their house, fixing their car. Chuck's girlfriend needs new brakes, asks me, I cast up my arms and call, who knows? Am I desired or despised and rejected? A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief? Though don't hide your faces from me just because I've borne your sorrows. You see me as stricken, smitten by God and afflicted, but I'll tell you what, I don't cry at this wound. You gotta be tough, tough as nails in the father who bore them. Bear the chastisement alone, the bruise for your iniquities. So you can take your peace. Sure, I'm in debt, don't have enough dough to fix these spotted and crooked teeth, gnarled roots and dim pearls twisting in on themselves, yellow and brown as a banana jelly belly. Still, their stains you witness with relief, thanking the good heavenly father your chops don't suggest streaks or stipple, but look closer, now closer, and aha, hurrah, and hallelujah! By these stripes you are healed. Shit. Anyways, like I was saying, maybe I'll get my builder's license. Did call to find out what I need to do. Thing is, sometimes keeping on with the business, casting nets in the known sea, don't make much sense. Because all we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned, every fucking A one of us, turned his own way. And the honest truth is, there's got to be an easier gig. I mean, I'm real grateful to the dad, don't get me wrong. I worked for him a long time, since I was 13, and he taught me everything he knew. Hell, all I needed to know. Oh, sure, it's like my sister say, like he used to say, I could take over his work. But let's be honest, I'm not so sure I want to. Not so sure I want to take and do hard labor my whole long life long. I mean, it's a daily grind of donkey work, and maybe I'm a jackass, but when I stop and think, it's like, is this the way I want to make my way? No offense to Dad, but he worked himself ragged for hours every day, and for what? A pittance and a little litter of little nippers to divide it by. The Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all, that's all. And I'm sure he almost always had work. The man did a good job. People liked him and his work. Plus, he was dirt cheap, poor and cheap, oppressed, afflicted. Yet he never opened his mouth. Honest worker, led as a lamb to the slaughter. He'd charge what he thought fair, and though he could have asked for more, shoot the quality of work he did. His hourly was way too low. She complained about that, all right. I'll tell you what. I'd rather do something like Dave. Man clears 50 grand a year, easy. Doing what? Buying and selling. Holds those auctions, and he's talented, but still, first-rate day will bring him in 20, 25 grand, a day of work. You have 2 days like that, and you're done for the year. No silent sheep before it shears there. Shit, you gotta open your mouth, sound off, and be heard. But look at the reward, man, the share of the bacon you're bringing in. Money free from prison and judgment, the declaring glare of your generation. Because all they care about is if you got cash. No matter how you got it, money makes you a better man, means to be respected. Dad's a dying breed and shit, even if I don't know how he did it. I'd go crazy, cut off from the land of the living all day, every day for 30, 35 years, then coming home to slave away in the barn. Truth is, I almost couldn't handle as much as I did working for him, and just between you and me, I'd take and go smoke dope at break. Pot, you know, grass, cannabis. I'll tell you what, that was sheer maintenance. Stricken is what I am for the transgressions of my people. I'd rather make my grave with the wicked, with the rich at my death, come up in the truck, roll up the windows, and relax. Who knows how Dad regarded my activities? Never said anything anyway. The way I calculate it, smoking makes me mellow. I do no violence nor keep deceit in my mouth. My anger calms and I can work all the livelong day. It's like, whatever, man, I'll just be over here, laboring. Oh, I know. It was different for him. Too tough for you meant just right for me. That's what he used to say. Besides, he needed the cabbage, so many mouths to feed, backs to adorn, rooms to keep alight. He raised us up, and see how it pleases the father to bruise the son. So he gave me grief, and I vowed to become callous, strapping, and stalwart. I swore nothing would be too hard for me, and that's a ball-breaking promise to keep and sell. As he says, when you make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Amen to that. Don't know if Dad saw the labor of his soul and was satisfied, but I'll tell you what, I don't want any of it. I like having a life, like mornings to dink around, days to do stuff, and at night play some ball. Fucking A, I'm third base for this first-rate team, Division A, co-ed, way better than the team I was on last year. Fact is, my new team kicked my old team's ass at tournament last year. I was about the best player in that lineup, but those half-baked ass wipes didn't ask me back. See, it's all political, and Joe, the manager, has a couple relatives on the team this year, along with guys from Richmond & Co., the sponsoring company. Doesn't look like they're much interested in baseball anyway. Don't practice worth a damn for the way that they go gallivanting after a game, always at the same location, College Street Bar and Grill, over on Lake Drive. Fucking A, I carried their lame asses last year, yet they never realized my knowledge justified many, as I bore their iniquities, you bet. Just as well. I mean, shit, doesn't matter if you can throw money at a team. Can you throw a ball? That's the issue. And don't go saying, oh, I'm still a little wet behind the ears, because if you're playing with the league, you should have been playing a few years at least. This team I'm on now, who knows where they came from, the riverbanks for all I care, but they can play some ball all right. And man, they keep me moving, because that's all they care about is if you can play. Like the girls on the team, they're all dykes. Shit, they don't cause me no headache or hitch, because they can play some ball, some mean old ball, praiseworthy and to the point. Some of the other guys get all agitated, won't really address them one way or another, but not me. I'm just like, hey, dude, what's up? I mean, they look like dudes, and heck, who wouldn't want to date a lady? Divide me a portion with the great, I say, and I'll divide the spoil with the strong. Speaking of which, you want a kitten? Just gave a couple away last week, but Mantha B's going to have another litter. Multitudes, I tell you, multitudes and mouths to feed. Chuck's new girlfriend, the one with the bum brakes, wanted one. She talked and talked all about it. Fucking A, I knew within 5 minutes, heck, 8 seconds, there was no way in hell or grave I'd ever subject a cat to that. Poor thing wouldn't get a moment of peace, and I'd be pouring out my soul unto death, numbering up with the transgressors. Man, you should have seen this last litter, too. Oh, so cute, just like Mantha B. I gave away the tiger striped, kept the two black and white ones with me, and they're growing larger every day. Just the most adorable ever. One of them, Tiny Bee, must have walked on prickles or something because he had a little thorn in his foot. I caught him limping, and when I checked him out, I found this little sliver that needed to be pulled. Yeah, he let me. They all let me. They follow me around the house, out in the yard. Heck, Mantha Bee didn't try to bear her first litter on my lap. I come home from work, sat down there on the sofa, and she got right up on my lap and starts in crying and contracting. It was like, oh, Mantha, I don't know if this is such a great idea. It took a while, but she let me move her to a box in the basement. I stayed with her all night, all right, waiting. I mean, it took her all night to birth. The first came a little after 11, and the last waited till dawn, 6:12 in the morning to be dead on. Ever since, she likes me to pet her during labor. I mean, she's doing hard work, and me rubbing her real gentle, careful and slow, down the nose and behind the ears, calms her. I soothe her side, too, long and easy, in between kits. She's had 6 litters, and every one she waited for me before she begun. And I always stay the whole while through as we bear the sin of many, making intercession for the transgressors.
Okay, I will start. So, Daniel, whose piece you just read, for those of you who haven't had the opportunity yet to read this collection, is just one of a cast of many characters who are speaking in this text. He's one of 5 siblings, and then in the other stories there are several other people, all I think from a certain area of the country, Michigan.
Michigan.
Yeah, and each one given this very delicately done voice. And in the introduction too, David Uhland mentions that this is a collection very much focused on voice. And all sort of strung together by the Old Testament, really, Old Testament mm-hmm. voices in the Bible too. Mm-hmm. And the first question I have really is, these voices then, needing to put them down on paper, what originally drove you to do that?
For this particular, this book came out of my real dad dying. So it was shortly after his death that I was just, I come from a really large family in Michigan. Mm-hmm. So it was that thing where the things that people keep repeating and saying over and over to each other that are sort of haunting you, that I started writing down. And then it took time to, you know, so the first piece was actually the hurrah, hurrah piece, but it was much different in the first form. And then it eventually evolved into this.
The Daniel piece, like mm-hmm. Specifically, I was interested in the kind of odd confidence in his voice. It's like he's constantly kind of backsliding and making like kind of not excuses for himself. It's more like, yeah, they say that like I, you know, I'm just a lazy dude, but you know, he's like, it's like, whatever, man, I'll just be over here laboring, you know.
Right.
And he's like which is great. I mean, it's funny. And Daniel's voice specifically, the kind of construction you make of this, you know, kind of down and out, what I would say Midwestern, but it's like northern Midwest.
No,
character.
It's Midwestern. Yeah,
yeah.
People there in Michigan.
Yeah,
yeah.
But the way that the kind of like the kind of odd confidence that comes through. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think one of the other things that is very much throughout this book is looking at gender. And so, that character in particular is, it's all of these posturings of maleness that he's doing. But at the same time, it's like he's, you know, a working class like guy with, you know, teeth falling out of his head. And so his experience of being in the world is very much marked by class.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's that thing of like, you know, trying to posture the maleness.
Yeah.
And I think he, in some ways, because the book, you know, begins with kind of this really perverted old man, mm-hmm. like this short piece about a perverted old man.
Yeah.
And the female, the female in that story, which is the waitress who he like basically stalks and, you know, watches her have sex and is like a,
right.
you know, and she has, you know, she's basically just watched. It's all through his perspective. But then the idea is that the arc of the book, I really tried to build it so that by the last piece, which is just this sort of prodigal daughter voice. And so there's, even though it's separate stories, I was really trying to build this thing where the voice would come, there would be some kind of movement
yeah.
towards something else.
Yeah, so you're using micro plots in each little story
yeah.
to drive these voices, but it seems like thematically, like you're saying, it,
mm-hmm.
the voice is, you could almost look at the changing of voice throughout the piece is more as the structuring element or the, what would normally be used as the plot, you know?
Right.
Yeah, that's great.
At the same time, giving the voices to many of the first person narratives, it makes it difficult for the reader to pass any kind of judgment. When you said the first guy is a pervert, I mean, it's like really the first time I thought, oh yeah, he kind of is, isn't he? I just sort of read him and thought, like, here's a dude that uh-huh. lives his life this way. And in fact, yes, he is stalking somebody. And it's like,
yeah, no,
kind
I actually
gross.
Had a friend, a writer who I quite, you know, I really respect her work. And she, when she read that piece, she was like, do not put this in your book. Don't start with it. If I picked up this book and I didn't know you, I would never read more beyond it. You know?
It didn't occur to me then.
Yeah. But I obviously didn't take her advice.
Yeah. But it makes me think of like the judgment theme that sort of runs through, especially in Hurrah Hurrah, you know, with all the mm-hmm. brothers and sisters sort of judging each other and
yeah.
rivalries and sibling stuff. And yet, and also of course the voice of the prophets and
right.
going through there and the word iniquity comes up a lot and the sin and stuff like that. And of course, I mean, I think today we'll hear more about this too, but the Bible and Christianity mm-hmm. being sort of, to me, a heavy influence as far as another voice mm-hmm. sort of coming through, weaving through these people. Is that something you could talk about?
Sure. I grew up in a very religious family, and so it was like pretty much like one of the only books that we were allowed to really read was the Bible. And so, and at the point where I started writing and had somebody point out to me that a lot of that my syntax structures were actually sort of biblical syntax structures, I mean obviously in translation, like the King James or in translation, so I just became very interested in that idea of how a text, and for me, the text that happens to be is the Bible, but how that becomes literally imprinted within the breath of a person. And that's part of why in this work in particular, because it's a work that is really trying, it's like the large question of reckoning a life, like what is a life worth? And that kind of idea of judging a life, and that the texts, the biblical texts, you know, there's so much judgment, both, you know, quite literally, but also that we culturally that we bring to them. And I'm trying to remember. I know like the Hurrah Hurrah. There's two chapters of Isaiah that are actually, you know, just woven through. Very, it's just. Very much in order, which became one of the constraints of actually writing the text, was to put them in. And so there's one that's actually spread out throughout the whole book, but then Dan has a whole chapter shoved right into him. He does. Yeah. And then there's in the other story, I am their music.
Yeah, there's a lot of direct quotations there too, right?
Yeah, and that's actually more from the passages that would be read during those masses.
Okay.
Because the characters are Pete and Matthew, I think. Pete and Mark.
Mark, yeah.
Okay, so it would actually be the passages that, because you know, like in Catholic Mass, there's always. People know this, or
no? Go ahead.
Okay, there's always three scriptures read. There's always something from the Old Testament. Then there's always something from the New Testament, mm-hmm. Usually from the epistles from St. Paul, mm-hmm. and the commentator would read those. And then and then there is always something from the Gospel, and that would be read by the priest.
Can you talk about that story? I am their music, because you're talking about. In the hurrah, hurrah, kind of a reckoning of a worth of a life. And in I Am Their Music, there's kind of a weird, weird is not a good word for it, but there's a character that, if I remember right, lost his son. And,
right.
Yeah, and just, there's a, it's interesting because I think this happens a lot in hurrah, hurrah as well, but there's a humor in these stories that's you know, comes sometimes from the people's particular kind of voice. Like I quoted the thing where it was, you know, it's like, whatever, man, I'll just be over here laboring. And, you know, that's
right.
funny.
Right.
You know, but it's also just the character's voice. And then in I Am Their Music, there's this guy that's just obsessed with cartoons. And,
right.
you know, and the kind of weird situation that gets set up there is just kind of absurd and ridiculous. But, you know, can you talk about the way that you're incorporating humor in a weird way?
Yes.
Well, I think in a lot of cases with these characters, their situation is so bad.
Yeah.
You know, that it is the thing, and there's a lot of trauma going on. And I think that there's something in when you're dealing with trauma that it becomes that the only way to really deal with it is to have this, it becomes so absurd, it does become absurd in the hysterical horribleness of it. Sure. I know in I Am Their Music, that particular character, part of the thing of the cartoons is for him anyway, I was looking at the idea of a belief being so something so artificial and so exterior and so not at all about flesh or clay or breath, you know? Yeah. So Jesus to him would be the equivalent of, you know, Bugs Bunny.
Right.
Or God and Bugs Bunny are, you know, become the same. Which is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that particular character almost behaves like a prophet, but he draws on, you know, this bank of cartoons instead
right.
of... that for him, that's the word of the Lord.
Right.
So, that's something else really altogether.
No, and I think it's the logic, though, too. I mean, part of it, again, is that thing where it's like the logic of where I grew up. You know, it's like I have an uncle that got a goat because he thought that then he wouldn't have to mow his lawn anymore. But this is in the country, so the lawn is like many acres. And so what is a goat? It's like the, you know, and so quickly within like 2 hours, the goat became actually, it was named Nana, and its name changed to No-No Nana because what it instead went for was all the junk that he had on his property, like all the metal, you know.
He's chewing on the metal.
Yeah. You know, but it's like, okay, that's, you know, the normal thing. And so then No-No Nana is, you know, part of the family. And
That's incredible.
Well, I think in the introduction to Requiem, David Yunlin was talking, I guess, I talked with you and was talking about kind of like Flannery O'Connor influence mm-hmm. or... Faulkner, and just in reading this stuff, and I've read, you know, a bunch of the Faulkner and O'Connor, and it's interesting to me how that I really think you did pull this kind of, I mean, I don't know if you did it on purpose or if it was mm-hmm. something you purposely decided to do, but it did resonate that in a way, this kind of Southern literature tradition steeped in religion where, you know, that type of stuff coming out of that area in the time that it did, like a Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor, makes perfect sense. And my experience living in the Midwest and the upper Midwest, it's similarly, I mean, you talk about Faulkner type stuff. We talk about a kind of like desolate landscape of the South.
Right.
And the upper Midwest is, you know, I mean, people talk about Kansas as being totally like nondescript, but I mean, the upper Midwest can be just as kind of a desolate landscape in a different way. And steeped in religion, I've never lived in the South, so I can't really compare it, but it does seem like, you know, Requiem as a book, and then, you know, and other stuff you've worked on are totally investigating this kind of like Northern religiosity, which is, which has a lot of the tropes that like Faulkner would do. Cause you can read Faulkner and you can like, there's funny moments. Oftentimes
right.
they're funny, like in a kind of gothic way, of course, right. Where it's kind of like funny. Ooh.
Right.
You know, but I mean like the humor here, like, I mean, I'm going back to this, but I mean, it's truly funny. And I don't feel like you're not using it to really like, talk down to the characters that you're writing at all in any way. It seems like more you're revealing something else. I don't so if you want to talk about your relationship with those other writers and
I mean I love I remember like first reading Flannery O'Connor, and it was that thing. It was like I just couldn't believe it. Like I couldn't believe that this, you know, I just like sort of my head fell off and I couldn't leave my apartment for the weekend because It resonated so much. I've read, and I've actually, it's since I've, when I first, after I wrote the first draft of Hurrah, Hurrah is when people started talking more about Faulkner. I hadn't actually read him then. Yeah. So I went and read, then I read a bunch of his stuff too. But I think that what I like about both of those writers and with more Southern writers in particular is this thing of that it's the thing that resonates is this thing of the belief and that the people truly do believe and that that's both a beautiful and a horrible thing
right.
Because of what they're placing their belief in. I think O'Connor is really interesting to me in particular because of that thing where there's always a moment of grace. There's always a moment where the character has a decision to be made, and there's something, and grace usually comes through the most unlikely, superficially unlikely source. And though, of course, you know, she's very Catholic, and she is writing. The other thing that's interesting to me is that she's writing very much. Where she's like, there is one interpretation of my stories, and my stories are intended to do one particular thing, which is to try to, you know, wake people up to the divine truth of Catholicism. Of the and yet they're not, they don't work at all in a didactic or one-dimensional way. But that thing of the moment of grace is something that I think especially, I mean, like, I think that that's the, like that Daniel section that I read, here's this very tough guy who's doing all this posturing, who's like smoking pot whenever he can, who's, you know, he's probably not the nicest guy, you know, and people would probably be upset and offended by him. And then there he is with those kittens. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to, you know, helping to birth these kittens. And so that's, I think, that moment of...
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of key moment, right? Because because he's doing all this posturing, and then you see him as a... In that moment, you see him as a really tender individual. I mean, it makes him much more human, like, at that point. And it's also, like, the kind of... Like we were talking about earlier, it seems like that arc of voice throughout the piece has got a turning point there as well, because...
Right.
Maybe he's becoming like, I mean, he's a mother figure there.
Right.
You know, which
right.
is just, you know, wonderfully odd.
It's right. the same in I Am Their Music, where at the end, this totally, I mean, in my mind, the image is, you know, this working class dude with a pot belly standing on a fence singing songs to some guy who's swaddled in his bed sucking his thumb. And it's
right.
It's quite, you know, unholy in a way, but actually holy at the same time, you know? So
right.
It's really beautiful that kind of thing happens there. I wanted to come back. Did you have to the judgment theme?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think in Hurrah Hurrah, and actually just the whole narration of all these stories, it makes me think or wonder, you know, in this case, maybe not always, what the writer, narrator is in relation to, in the framework of this whole theme of God and judgment and the ants and hurrah, hurrah, and, you know, wiping them out or
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. Like, how would you describe the narrator's role and then, you know, from there, the author, as far in that framework?
Oh, okay. Let me think here a second. That was me thinking.
Father calls the son.
Well, the thing that, okay, in that piece in particular, the hurrah, hurrah piece, so that narrator who is sort of like the piece goes back and forth between these voices and then this child who is observing ants. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, the narrator is this child, the ant child, right? I guess I'm confused still what you're asking.
Well, like the omniscience of the narrator, but also we talked about, you know, then there not being much irony or judgment in mm-hmm. the work or from the narrator, but just, you know, putting these people in these places. I mean,
right.
the author
right.
has this power.
Okay.
And
right, and I think that in that way, it's actually that particular character is kind of, I guess, the metaphor for the narrator, because it's overall, and in some ways, I guess how I feel about writing, where it's like you're observing all of these small creatures going about their business, and in the end, what you do is smash them because you write, you know, lies and betray. I mean, writing is never there's a part of writing that's not very nice. It's not a nice thing to do, and so it is that that smashing of the anthill.
Yeah.
Does that?
No, that's good. Yeah.
Do you, maybe we want to read since we have all these questions about why did you write that way? you did write for it's the way that Les Figues works. The press is that at the beginning of the year, you guys do the trench art series, which mm-hmm. is like aesthetic statements from each of the authors mm-hmm. that you're going to publish throughout the year. So. We had asked if you wanted to read from your aesthetic statement.
So just to explain this a little bit more, the Les Figues, the press that I'm part of, we publish 4 writers a year, and the idea is that this is work that's in conversation with each other, and as part of that conversation, we ask each of the writers to write an aesthetic statement or a poetics that is published separately as the first title of the series. And so this was I'm going to just read some of the aesthetic that I wrote that was published in this book, Trench Art Materiel. And for mine, because of all of the religious themes and actual, biblical narrative structure stuff that I look at, that I use, I wrote a catechism. So it's called A Catechism of Aesthetics for a Time of Religious War. And for people that don't know, a catechism is basically a creed of faith that's given, and that then if one wants to convert to a particular faith, they are questioned on that creed of faith. And there's a very formal process for learning your catechism and for learning the correct correct answers to each of the questions. And usually it will start with a block of text and then break out each of the sentences or articles in the text and further explore them. So I actually took the Apostles' Creed from the Catholic faith and rewrote it So I will now read it. Number one, what do you believe? We believe in art, creation's grand creation, sucker of human sorrow, accuser of human error, in literature as liturgy and testament, conceived in necessity, born in humility, bred of ambition, and suffering the weight of its forebears. We believe the artist descends into her work, for which she must examine herself and her sentences with honest ferocity, so she may, through some grace, make something true and transcendent rise from the dead sleep of dailiness and diversion. We believe the best art ascends more brilliant than its creator, to be held in the infinite, a model to be judged by the living and the dead. We believe in the muse, we call her passion, the canon, the communion of the saints, the solidness of sin, the redemption of a life, and hope, always hope, everlasting. Two, what are the number of articles in your creed? The number depends upon form and function. A, we are naked. B, we are 13, which indicate nouns, 11 indefinitive, and 2 indefinitely. C, 12 persists as tenets of faith. 12 is a good number, divisible by 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and itself. 3. Do you agree with this statement? True believers believe most truly in the tenets. No, true believers believe most truly. That is enough to bring both hope and harm. I give no proof, and proof is not required, but give me your ear, and I'll fill it with rationality and illusion. Still, all must be justified. 4. What is proclaimed in the first article of the creed? I believe in art, creation's grand creation, sucker of human sorrow, accuser of human error. Art is reflective and audacious, ancient and impulsive. Humans, creations themselves, with or without the art of the divine, formed in the womb from nature and the elements, fed on mother's blood in Edenic isolation, being one with the mother, held separate from chaos, come into this world and find it scary, learn they are subject and object, separate from the mother, and at this they are relieved and upset, deeply betrayed, and the world around them is good and bad and all in between. And when they have grown, some of these humans will make art. There is always at least one in each tribe and clan, one, at least one of each people, and one throughout time, and this artist creates art, and the fact of this art is universal. So too is the impulse to create, affecting calm and arousal. King Saul could not be still without David's harp. David witnessed Saul's infirmity while his heart held the prophet Samuel's anointing that he would replace Saul as king. Art intended for the gods shames humans into remembering all we are not. 5. What is meant by the second article, in literature as liturgy and testament? Great literature, by its complexion of complicated form and content, requires a concentration of focus, meditative musing away from the text, close exegesis of detail held at arm's length. This meditation should illumine the human heart and condition. As literature focuses the public's attention, is writing as a public service, is reading as a means of communication, instruction, ritualized belief. 6. Must there be a morality in literature? There is always morality in literature, for words create a world the reader enters into even as the reader is entered by this world. This is a place beholden to the author's imagination, for it is she who named this world and ordered it according to her reason and passion, that is, her moral view of the world told through her conscience and subconscious minds. 7. Why do you say morality and not ethics? Individuals make art, societies make ethics. Morality is the weight of an individual. Ethics is the consequence of social mores and standards. Individuals make moral decisions. Judiciaries make ethical decisions. Art is experienced in the deep solitary of the individual. Art exists beyond jurisdiction. 8. Aren't you using a very basic legalistic definition of morality? Yes and no. In the basic sense, I am using morality to mean the beliefs of an individual, that which she believes good or bad, right or wrong. One's base moral fabric is the basis for most decisions, even if one believes all is permissible. There is morality behind that permission, as the champion of amorality betrays a moral judgment. In a non-legalistic sense, morality is both A, part of the primal human psyche, and B, a structuring aesthetic principle, especially at the centennial line level. Should I stop there?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
You know what? I think, why don't we take a break?
Okay.
And we'll come back and talk about that stuff and then talk more about the current manuscript you're working on.
Great.
All right. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.